expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
He's security, but you.
Hey, everybody. This is Noelle Didler, and I am from Jackson, Mississippi. And I'm joined by Akhil Bakari, who's the state coordinator of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement for Mississippi. And I have on air joining us from Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Akinyele Umoja. And Mikaya Kambui will be with us shortly. So today, the focus of the radio show is the grassroots human rights struggle, a movement of self-determination, economic justice, political power, and system change. So I'm going to be moderating this conversation, so I'll be asking questions specifically to AK, Akhil, and Mikaya, not in that order, but I'll be asking those questions, and based on that responses, you'll be able to have a context for what is happening now to what has already happened over the last three centuries at least. So, three decades, sorry. So, welcome everybody to the show. So, I'm going to start off by asking Dr. AK to speak to your engagement in the Malcolm X grassroots movement, please.
One, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Free the land, brother.
Free the land, brother Akhil. And when I say brother Akhil, it's not just brother in a general sense, because Akhil and I are really like brothers. I miss him when I don't see him. But you asked about my engagement in Malcolm X grassroots movement. I actually have been active in Malcolm X grassroots movement since its inception. You know, some of our key leaders when we founded Malcolm X grassroots movement were Shokwe Lumumba, Dr. Safi Omari, and several other people from around the United States. And so I was very active from its inception. Our whole view of Malcolm X grassroots movement is during that particular time, as you might remember, Malcolm X grassroots movement was founded in 1990, and many of our youth were wearing like Malcolm X medallions, and you heard Malcolm X referred to in hip hop. And so we called our movement the Malcolm X grassroots movement, because we wanted to add some politics to that. We wanted to tie it to the grassroots struggle of our people for human rights. We felt like some of the, and we still believe, that some of the things that occurred to our people around the country were genocidal. And when we talk about that, we could clearly see it now when we see things like the Flint River, the Flint water crisis, or we look at things like how our children are being miseducated in the schools. They call it the achievement gap. That's what scholars and educators call it, the achievement gap. We consider it genocide, the fact that our children are being railroaded in something called the school to prison pipeline, things of that nature. And so we're not even, and we haven't even gotten to the fact that our people being killed every day on the streets of cities across the U.S. empire. And so those type of things motivated us to start the Malcolm X grassroots movement, to really tie the movement of the 60s and 70s to our reality then in the 1990s, but it continues on into the 21st century. And that's my involvement began with that, from the various things I was involved in, from being a student to being an educator to organizing our people in the streets of originally Los Angeles, but now in Atlanta, Georgia.
Thank you, Doc. So,
some of the things that kind of motivated me in the movement.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. We're going to come back to you. So, Akhil, share with us your story of becoming a member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement. I heard the story before, but I think it's very important that the audience hear the story and understand how folks from different regions, folks from different ideologies come together to shape this movement called the Malcolm X grassroots movement that has made tremendous impact across the nation state and in specific areas too, which is inspiring a bunch of us in Jackson to be part of the work as allies and as comrades. So I would love for you to share your personal story.
Thank you, Noel. It's very interesting, and I think I've shared this with AK, and I'm not sure. At that period of time, previous to the initial founding of MXG, which was founded right here in Jackson, Mississippi, by the way, I was personally searching for, I knew something was wrong, and it was not correct, here in America, and specifically here in Mississippi and in Jackson. I inherently understood something was wrong, but I didn't know exactly what it was and why, as it related to the struggles of black people here. So I felt like I needed to be a part of some sort of organized effort in order to be more effective. So it's very interesting. There was an event given here at an historic Masonic temple in Jackson, Mississippi, and the event was featuring Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. And so, in attending that event, I had every intention of joining the Nation of Islam. However, the opening for that event was conducted by Safi Omari and Chokwe Lumumba. Chokwe spoke very briefly, and the bulk of the introduction of Minister Farrakhan and the I guess warming up process for about 30 minutes Dr. Omari, Safiya gave. And after her 30-35 minute introduction, I knew then what I wanted to do and who I wanted to do it with as far as the organization that they was putting forth. So that was my beginnings and introduction into the work of the Malcolm X grassroots movement.
Thank you, Akhil.
Add something to that?
Sure, Doug.
I also remember around that time in Jackson when Akhil joined, and I kind of associate Akhil with this, but there was the Klan was marching.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yes.
And then Akhil, I know, became very active in the MXGM. And for those of you who don't know, that's what we acronym we say for Malcolm X Grassroots, MXGM.
Mm-hmm.
And leaders like not only Chokwe Lumumba, Safi Omari, but also Charles Tisdale, they organized to protest that march to show that black people in Jackson, Mississippi were not going to be intimidated by the Ku Klux Klan. And so MXGM played a very critical role in that and other things in Jackson during that time. I know in anticipation of there being a black mayor in Jackson, during that time, Malcolm X Grassroots Movement worked with other organizers to organize Kill, you might correct me. Was it the grassroots political convention?
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm.
To organize and get a black agenda for the black community. So the black community, if they were going to elect a black mayor, would elect somebody with a particular agenda. I think, and Akil could speak on this better than I can, it was that effort was undermined. But me being an outsider looking in, you know, I don't live in Jackson, but I feel like it's a second home to me. I always felt like that became the basis for what later would be Chokwe Lumumba's run for city council and mayor.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of having, even though we kind of link people's assembly to other things, I think mm-hmm. that played a key role in the thinking we had around that, because I remember Chokwe always saying he was looking at black politics prior to that, us running for mayor. And when I say us, I'm talking about black people in Newark, New Jersey, Philly, Los Angeles, and how we had these campaigns to have black mayors during that time. But oftentimes these people end up not serving our community, but serving corporate interests.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know Chokwe had in his mind, if we were going to run people for office, we mm-hmm. had to have a different agenda that didn't represent the rich, the corporations, or privileged black folks, but had to represent the grassroots.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of what is a background to why the whole concept of having a people's assembly and things like that occur in Jackson. I really feel, I almost think like when I go to Jackson, Keel tell you, I tell him this all the time, that y'all are doing some special stuff there that people across the country need to pay attention to and figure out how we can implement this strategy of the place.
That's right. Thank you so much for sharing that, Doc. I want to quickly, I don't know who's going to pick up here. It could be either of you. I want to go back to that Klan march that AK was referencing, because people need to understand black radicals and people engaged in black power movement, what kind of dangers they faced, what kind of state repressions they faced, I want to also go to AK's book and how it talks about the armed resistance in Mississippi too. But care to respond to sharing the story of the Klan march, please?
Yeah, it was actually one of the first actions that I was privileged to be a part of. Right. As a new member in the organization. And I remember distinctly the organizing effort in putting that together. And it was truly a grassroots movement, because we had all elements of our community in it. We had young people, we had older people, we had children, we had women, we had men. It really encompassed the strata of the community here. You know, we also had conscious and white people of goodwill who were also a part of that march. And the focus of it was that, you know, the Klan was not going to feel invited and have carte blanche in marching down the streets of Jackson, Mississippi. We were not having that. And so we had roughly anywhere from 2,500 to 3,000 people that participated in that march.
Wow.
And we started the march in the historic Ferris Street District. And it was as we...
Explain to our listening audience what historic Ferris Street is.
Historic Ferris Street... that area was the hub of the black business district coming through the 30s, 40s, 50s, and the early 60s when I was a child. It was the where you had, again, black businesses, dentist's office, doctor's office, shoe shops, black attorneys, obviously black funeral homes. Mm-hmm. The historic Alamo Theater was there, and at that particular time, when that was the only theater that black people were allowed to attend, mm-hmm. as I did as a child. So, very significant place to start the rally and march against the Klan. And as we proceeded from Ferris Street,
and this was what year now?
This was in 1988, 89, somewhere in there. As we started on the march, mm-hmm. through Ferris Street, and the people in the community began to understand what we were about to embark. So they came out of the homes to join the march. Mm. And so as we moving into downtown Jackson, and we were at the intersection of Jackson where West Street goes into the downtown area.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And a very ironic piece on the left side of us there was the old Confederate cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And so we planned our point that was the point where we would not allow the Klan to move into downtown Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we made our stand. Every law enforcement agency in the state of Mississippi was present.
Mm-hmm.
We had a column of state police in front of us in riot gear and M16s pointed toward us. There were snipers on the roofs of state buildings behind us.
Mm-hmm.
There was a column of sheriff's department officers to our right, and any other unknown agencies that we could not see. So essentially, the state enforcement apparatus was essentially protecting the Klan from us.
Mm-hmm.
However, we made our stand and we declared that they would not move any further in their advance into downtown Jackson. And after a standoff where the state law enforcement apparatus determined that we were not going to move, and that we would not be intimidated, they backed off, and the Klan backed off.
Wow.
So, and it was, you know, it showed to our people that we had courage,
mm-hmm.
and that we would defend our people and the concept of this being our city to them. And so, to AK's point, those kinds of events, and there was a bunch of those, some not so grand of that. I think right after that, AK, we had a huge human rights march that a lot of our people participated from around the country. I think, do you remember that? Right after that, I think a year or so after that, we had a huge human rights march.
Hmm. Where was that?
That was here in Jackson, Mississippi, down Capitol Street.
Okay.
And, you know, linking the struggles that black people face here, their day-to-day struggles, to the larger concept of human rights.
Wow. Hmm.
That was actually when Damballa came down. Never left.
All right.
But at any rate, that was the one of the defining moments, and it also showed the huge contradiction to the concept of having black leadership in office. At that time, there was not a black mayor present.
Mm-hmm.
However, there were black city council people, mm-hmm. who actually conspired to prevent us from marching and stopping the Klan.
Mm.
And so that huge contradiction was borne out by the actions that the grassroots movement put forth along with others, and that the broader community participated in.
Mm. So what was the purpose of the march? Why did you guys think that a march was necessary.
You know,
it is a form of public and collective resistance, right?
So, yes, and given the history of Klan violence and terror,
right,
in the South, and mm-hmm. particularly in Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
People feel that in a visceral way,
mm-hmm.
and it was mm-hmm. very important to us,
mm-hmm.
right,
to show that we would stand against that, and that they could stand against that.
Mm-hmm.
It was very important.
Mm-hmm. AK, in your book, you do talk about how, you know, people in the rural part of Mississippi who were armed and who were ready to resist violence that was coming to civil rights workers and leaders of the civil rights movement who were from Mississippi and also not from Mississippi. You mention a lot of that history in the book. Armed resistance or standing against such violent forces as the Klan is nothing new to, Black people in the South or anywhere, right? So,
right.
But I think this march you are referring to,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if people were able to, mirror what happened in the 60s. And see that you guys were doing nothing new, mm-hmm. but actually reaffirming resistance and asserting it in the shape of this black struggle and fight for black power. Would you say that?
Well, we not realized that we were standing on the shoulders
mm-hmm.
of those who initiated struggle in the 50s and the 60s.
Uh-huh.
In the 70s in Mississippi. If you look at my book, it covers from the 50s through the late 70s the work of places like Holly Springs and Tupelo and Bahia and up in the northern part of the state, the United League of Mississippi. And Shokwe actually, before he moved to Mississippi, had come down and participated in some of those marches during that time. So we knew about those traditions, and we knew about the work of people like Fannie Lou Hamer, and we knew about the Deacons for Defense.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time that first the New African People's Organization and then Malcolm X Grassroots Movement,
mm-hmm.
a lot of those movements weren't as active; they weren't there anymore, and so. We recognize things like those marches that occurred in Jackson was building on a tradition. And so, and I know that Shokwe had been in touch. He had been to Jackson before and he had participated in this stuff, and he was able to talk to people like Rudy Shields, who was an organizer that organized in the Jackson Black United Front and had also organized several boycotts throughout the state and organized the last years of his life in Yazoo City. And so Rudy Shields is a big part of my book, but the person, mm-hmm. there's two people who told me about Rudy Shields,
mm-hmm.
and three actually. Chokwe Lumumba, who had worked with Rudy Shields and when he was in Mississippi in the early 70s. Charles Tisdale, editor or the publisher of the Jackson Advocate, and a brother in Jackson, Mariba Lumumba, who had lived in Yazoo City. And they're the ones that gave me the background to even know, having a sense to talk about them in my book. But it were activists like Rudy that we were building on the shoulders of. It's not that we were bringing something, maybe we were bringing a little different twist to it. When I say we, I wasn't there, but it was part of my family who was there, so I feel like we. But at the same time, we knew there was a tradition there. There was something. This is why when Shokwe runs for mayor and he ties himself to the tradition of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not like we're saying there was nothing there when we came and we're starting something new. No, we're building something, but we're building on a tradition that's already there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so yes, there was stuff before us, and we just were picking that up in the 1990s and taking it to the day, you know.
That's right.
We're building on that tradition, mm-hmm. and bringing whatever we've learned since that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing that, AK. Again, Akhil, do you want to share about the first grassroots?
Yeah, I'll give you a little context and background for that. It was clear, given that time, and this was around 92, that the demographics were such in Jackson that a black mayor would be elected. And Memphis had just elected a black mayor. There was a gentleman who came down to speak to a person we worked with and helped organize the anti-Klan rally, a person, Ali Shamsuddin, who's mm-hmm. currently a municipal judge. He came down and spoke with Ali about how to put together a process that would, whereby the black community would organize itself to select a candidate
mm-hmm.
to run for the mayoral office.
Mm-hmm.
And Ali thought it was a good idea, and he asked Mr. Charles Tisdale, as well as our organization in the person of Chokwe Lumumba and myself, to sit down and see how we could implement what was done in Memphis.
Mm-mm. Tell us about what happened in Memphis.
Memphis idea, I think the Willie Herndon Mm-mm. was the first black mayor that was elected in Memphis right. during that period. I think he served at least two, maybe three terms.
Okay.
The idea was that the black community would put together a process whereby candidates who wanted to run for that office
mm-hmm.
would have to go through this process of vetting that was specific to the black community
mm-hmm.
and that there would be an agenda put forth to serve the interests of black folks. Now, they organized all aspects of the community, whether the churches, sororities, fraternities, neighborhoods, black businesses, to get on board with that effort.
Mm.
And not really knowing all of the dynamics of the Memphis effort, but they were successful in putting forth the candidate that they selected to run.
Right.
So, again, the idea was put to us, and we sat down and formulated a strategy. Now, we felt like our role, as far as the grassroots movement, was to ensure that, mm-hmm. as Dr. Umoja mentioned earlier, that the agenda reflected the aspirations of the entire community, particularly the grassroots community mm-hmm. in the city, and mm-hmm. that to ensure that their voice not only would be heard, but there would be a voice that would be part of the decision making.
Right.
And so we felt that that was our charge and our contribution to ensure the purity of that effort. And so we moved forward with it. And it's interesting, the dynamic, when you really challenge power and you're attempting to seize power.
Mm-hmm.
We were met with tremendous obstacles. As a matter of fact, the local daily news at that time, the Clarion Ledger, which still exists today, I think for 2 months they ran front page stories denouncing us because of our idea that this event, these events, and this process was strictly for black people.
Mm-mm.
And that we had the right to caucus amongst ourselves.
Exactly. Mm.
And to devise a strategy to have an end that would culminate in electing a black mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very successful grassroots conventions. We had two. The first one, there was roughly 2,500 people that attended, as well as the second one that had an equal number of people.
Mm.
And the way it was, we had the community was broken down by the wards.
Mm-hmm.
The ward system had just been put in place, and I have to give you this context. Jackson, prior to the work of the late, great Senator Henry Kirksey,
mm-hmm.
who championed all of his life
right.
for the human rights and self-determination of black people in the state of Mississippi,
right.
particularly in the electoral arena.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to him filing lawsuits against the state and the city for lack of representation for black folks, there was what was called a commission form of government, commissioners and one mayor
mm.
that oversaw the entire
city
of Jackson.
Wow.
And so black people had no representation whatsoever.
Right.
In their in a city where they obviously pay taxes just mm-hmm. like everybody else did. So it was the efforts of the late Senator Kirksey, who not only filed the successful lawsuits,
mm-hmm.
but his formal training was that of a map maker.
Mm-hmm.
So he also drew the ward lines. And so the current form of government that we have, which is the mayor council
mm-hmm.
with seven wards
mm-hmm.
And seven representatives to the council, we give thanks to the late, great Henry Kirksey.
Awesome.
So coming out of that into the convention, the community was broken down by the wards that they lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was for them to caucus and come up with their... we gave them the central platform of the agenda. And we actually had community meetings
mm.
a week put
mm.
from the community about what should go into the agenda. I had the pleasure of myself and Dr. Ivory Phillips,
mm-hmm.
who's one of the great educators at Jackson State University,
that's
here,
right.
Safia Omari, Shokwe Lumumba, and others
mm.
who helped put together the grassroots platform.
Mm.
Again, that's, as AK mentioned, that was the precursor
right.
to our present-day electoral efforts.
Right, right.
So, at any rate... those candidates, black candidates who had had aspirations to run for mayor, we asked that they come through the convention.
Mm-hmm.
And the favorite, we Senator Kirksey, Community Act Senator Kirksey to run.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, he was in his early 70s, and he was really reluctant to run based on his age.
Mm-hmm.
The community convinced him that because of his... lifetime commitment
mm.
to the uplift of black folks and to the betterment of Mississippi
right.
that he should run, and that we would refine the process whereby he would run and he would serve one term
mm.
and that we would refine the process so that we could again get the best candidate to run after his first 4 years.
Mm.
So the community convinced him to run, and Creedell Calhoun, a current state legislator,
mm-hmm.
also was planning to run, and he agreed to come through the convention, which was one of the few positive contributions he's made.
Mm-hmm.
But he did agree to go through the through the grassroots convention.
Mm-hmm.
Three-term mayor, and actually the first black mayor that was elected, not out of this convention,
mm-hmm.
Harvey Johnson had made overtures that he was going to run, and had made an initial commitment to run through the convention.
Mm-hmm.
However, at the last minute, he reneged on that
mm-hmm.
commitment. And so Senator Kirksey emerged out of the convention as a candidate. There were economic forces, the white economic power structure at work
right.
to undermine, as well as the political structure. And there were also people within our own community
mm-hmm.
who were recruited by the power structure to undermine the process.
Right.
Two conventions were held. The community was energized mm-hmm. around it.
Mm-hmm.
Harvey did not run through it, but he did actually run for mayor. It effectively split the vote in the black community, and the mayor at that time was a Kane Ditto. He was able to secure a second term. Mm. Because he was able to secure a second term, he was able to solidify the mechanisms by which the bedroom communities around Jackson, who sucked the economic life out of Jackson, he was able to secure though a lot of those mechanisms, and it contributes to part of the economic woes that Jackson faced to this day. So it was very historic in that if we had been successful at that point, Jackson would probably look very much different.
Absolutely.
Than it does today.
I agree. To me, the process that you described seems so people-centered and deeply democratic and self-determined from the perspective of a place, which is Jackson. So it's place-based, it's self-determined, mm-hmm. and it is deeply democratic and people-centered. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, when I think about that and look at the political fragmentation of an 85% black city right now, it kind of, you know, I guess... as an insider, outsider, as a brown immigrant, you know, for me, it's kind of mildly disappointing. But at the same time, you know, it gives me a sense of the history that we can look back upon and learn from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, without reinventing the wheel, to continue to do the work that we need to do and build people power through the many platforms that we have in existence right now, because that, as you said, became the precursor to the people's assemblies we have,
yes, yes.
that we all have been engaged in so many forms, right? And that also speaks to the economic justice work for the upliftment of people in the city of Jackson. And to me, all of that is kind of sort of this bigger frame for human rights, mm-hmm. where, you know, we get to respect and protect and fulfill the rights of the people. And that takes me again back to history. And I would love for you guys, AK or you, to talk about the history of Republic of New Africa and the relationship between RNA and MXGM, if possible.
I think AK was at the forefront of a lot of that work, so I will defer.
Okay.
Okay, and there's something else I want to bring up about Jack too, but I answer the question right now. In fact, I'm in Atlanta. People from the Provisional Government of Republic of New Africa actually celebrating their 49th anniversary here in Atlanta this weekend. But what the Republic of New Africa, Provisional Government of Republic of New Africa, is that in 1968, this weekend, 49 years ago, black leaders, black members of the Black Power Movement, mm-hmm. met in Detroit, Michigan. Queen Mother Moore, who was somebody who had been active since the Marcus Garvey days, Betty Sabazz, who was the widow of Malcolm X, the Gaidi and Mario Obadeli, who were founders, who were members of this group called the Malcolm X Society, Maulana Karenga, who founded Kwanzaa, Mary Baraka, who was a great writer, intellectual. All these black leaders met, and they were posed with the question of what was black power at that time. And they came up with the highest expression of black power would be black people governing themselves. And they called for reparations. They declared their independence from the United States. And they sought out to build a black nation. The place that they thought was the most fertile ground to build a black nation was in Mississippi, in a place they called the Cush District,
right.
which was the black majority counties that run along the Mississippi River, north from the Delta, all the way down south to like Fayette. Not Fayette. What's the county down there? Jefferson County.
Jefferson County.
That
yeah.
Part,
But even going deeper than that into Louisiana, all the way down to New Orleans, and then going as far north as to Memphis, you have a strip of land where black people are in the majority. And so they felt organizing there would bring about, again, a high expression of black power, a place we could organize for self-determination. And that's how the Republic of New Africa, or the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa, gets to Mississippi. And many of the people, your audience probably know the history of the RNA coming there with President Obadeli back in 1970. And they also know that that as soon as they tried to purchase some land, and their objective was to purchase some land to begin to not only organize on that land, but organize throughout those counties we talked about to build like medical clinics and build educational institutions and things that would uplift the black community. And then at some point to be able to call a vote to see if that area wanted to be independent or not. Mm-hmm. And, but the FBI, and if you could read the FBI files, if you could read the Sovereignty Commission files, they were very frightened of the potential of that group. Not to mention that a lot of people, you know, black people, we're talking about like when they get there, this is like 5 years, 5 to 6 years after you had the Voting Rights Act, and it hadn't really been implemented in the state. Mm-hmm. So a lot of black people who were later in office were kind of intrigued by the Republic of New Africa. Some of their biggest supporters were people like Benny Thompson, Robert Clark, who was in the state house. They were people who provided support. People like Aaron Shirley, who the medical mall is named after in the middle of Jackson, they all supported the Republic of New Africa. They weren't necessarily members, but they were working with them. And so I think that kind of scared the power structure at that particular time. So they moved on them as quick as they could. Of course, we know the incident that happened August 18, 1971, where at the Republic of New Africa resident in Jackson, there was a pre-dawn raid with a tank. Several FBI agents and Jackson police attacked them, shot into the residence before the sun rises. And fortunately, the people who were in the building survived. But through the battle that ensued, one of the police officers was killed, and two FBI agents was wounded. Police officers wounded, and much of the efforts of the RNA after that were kind of tied up into defense of 8 people who were in that residence and 3 others who were in another place. Mm-hmm. They charged people and tied them up in political cases. This is how, again, Chokwe Lumumba resides in Mississippi for a while, because he came back to work on the defense of his comrades. Mm-hmm. But that was, and the RNA was severely repressed in the state of Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And so whereas a lot of, again, like people like Aaron Shirley came out to support them during that time and spoke on their behalf. And while they might have been revered by certain parts of the black community, they were demonized by, the white supremacists and people of that nature, the white power structure in the state. But it's based on, again, those lessons that people like Chokwe would come back to Mississippi and organize on a different basis. We learned some lessons from that period of time. And so, again, just like we say, much of what we do is built on the shoulders of Medgar Evers and Fannie Lou Hamer, mm-hmm. and Rudy Shields, and folks like that, Skip Robinson. We also feel like it's built on the shoulders of Imari Obadeli and the people who came down, the people who were incarcerated during that time with RNA 11. Right. We try to build on that. I want to interject something else. There's another important part of history
I think that occurred in Jackson, and maybe Kakil can illuminate on, and maybe you might even have Hondo at another time to speak about this. And again, this is from me visiting and working with the family there in Jackson, MHEM family, but I feel another important thing that occurred in there that hasn't really been documented. And it's in history, you know, we always talk about our history, but sometimes we look at stuff that's distant and don't look at what happened, in, at least within my lifetime. But one of the things was, I know Shokwe took up the fight as a lawyer for black workers at Frito-Lay.
That's right.
That became a very important fight during a particular time. And again, it was a part of, and this was after we formed Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. Mm-hmm. And I remember Hondo was one of those labor leaders at Frito-Lay, and they became very successful in organizing black workers in that particular local, and they actually began to take over seats in the union. But because of that, the plant shut down in the face of black worker power in those places. Kill, can you speak on that a little bit more?
Yeah.
I think that's some important history that...
You raise a very good point. That was also a very important milestone, and it also helped. It was another area that helped solidify us within our community as an organization that immersed ourselves in the struggle of everyday people. And you're right, that's Hondo was very instrumental. As a matter of fact, they essentially... black people, organized black people, and they took over that union.
Mm-hmm.
And pushed it further than the actual union really wanted to go on behalf of black people. So much so that, as you said, that the Frito-Lay corporate management shut the place down, and there was even a struggle within the union to move it from the radical human rights self-determination based direction that Hondo and Shokwe and the people of Frito-Lay was moving it to. So you're right, that was a very significant piece of history that contributed to how we solidified ourselves as a grassroots movement within the community, and again was also a precursor to present times.
Mm. Thank you all so much for this amazing, you know, context of history, and also sharing us these personal narratives that show us how and why the movement kept evolving. Mm-hmm. As the people's lives kept evolving, and the political structures and the pressures of the political structures and the systems continue to repress and oppress, mm-hmm, communities, and how responsive these movements have been, and how responsible and accountable these movements have been to people and places. Mm-hmm. That's how I kind of understand what's happening. Mm-hmm. I clearly see the pathway from there to what's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
So one more question I have, I mean, we are almost at the 1 hour mark, and then we have one more hour,
okay,
to talk about, and there's a lot of historical ground that we need to cover, because we are doing a two-part series, 2 hours today, and moving on to 2 hours on April 7th, okay, also. So we can do the present kind of stuff then. Well, the question I have for you guys is, talk about the chapters in the movement, how each chapter does its own work, because I look at what's happening in Atlanta, the Quilombo, and mm-hmm, the Malcolm X Festival, right? And then in Jackson, we have People's Assemblies, Coalition for Economic Justice, and also People's Hurricane Relief Work, and then the security work and the legal work that you guys have been doing, and, of course, the electoral politics work, right? Mm-hmm. So just give us examples of some of the work that is getting done through the Malcolm X grassroots movement in the community for the past 25 years. I remember the center and how the center used to be where young people were trained and young people were educated and organized and how women used to be part of leading that work, all of that. So please talk about that. And I also want to acknowledge that Willie Jamal Wright, the scholar who's actually presenting his doctoral dissertation work and his writing about the history of RNA from the perspective of Detroit and Jackson has joined the call. So very excited about having him on the call with us. So, AK, do you want to talk about it first, or Akhil, how do you guys want to?
I'll let AK start. I know given how the chapters are set up and the work of the centers in each chapter, I'll let him start and give Jamal a shout out. Glad you're on the call, brother.
Hey, Jamal. And I also asked, I don't know if she's on yet, Sister Taliba, who's one of the people in the national leadership, just to talk about the national program.
Okay.
If she gets to call in. But,
all right, great.
I think the whole thing, again, from the inception was for each of the chapters, even though we have a national program, to really try to engage people in their local areas, but also use the skills of the organizers in each area to try to build a program that will resonate with the people in that area. And then some programs we take, when we figure out they work, we try to use them other places. Atlanta, as you mentioned, Noel, one of the things that we've been able to kind of spearhead is working with the youth.
Right.
Is working with young people. And so the part of our history has been organized through African Scout Organization,
right,
which is young people from 6 through 18. And then we also have a camp Punzico, which provides a summer experience for young people. What's funny kind of to me when I think about it, I remember when Antar Lumumba was a young person coming to camp. And when he was and then being in college when he was at Tuskegee and coming back and being a counselor at camp. And I also remember coming near to Jackson and helping with his rites of passage. Because that's one of the things we try to train leaders our youth experience. And so I kind of see him as one of those examples of a leader. Chokwe and Rukia as young people who we train as leaders. So when I'm in a meeting with them today and I see listen to them, I'm like, sometimes I move to tears because I just see young people we've been able to develop. I think of that with my own daughter Tashia, who now mentioned the Quilombo School.
Yes. Right.
From the scout experience, 11 years ago, my wife Aminata decided to found an independent school here in Jackson. I know Jackson used to have, I think it was the Black and Proud School.
Yes.
That the Lumumba children were a part of, at least Rukia was when she was a child. And but my wife founded the Quilombo Academic and Cultural Institute, and so my daughter Tashia, who came through our program, is now director of that school. Mm. So it's, we've done that to try to produce leaders with our children. And again, even though it's kind of based here in Atlanta, we've done it other places. And I know Dimitri Marshall, something similar with his son that was done with Antar back in the day in terms of rites of passage. And so I told him that you come out of the tradition, so you come, you know, you gotta carry on a tradition to other people who've gone through rites of passage with us. Of course, one of our allies in Mississippi, Baba Hannibal Free, was one of the people who kind of pioneered rites of passage throughout the country. And so taking from that, you all have done a great job of building people's assembly there. So one of the processes here in Atlanta, Atlanta's different from Jackson, so we can't build a people's assembly to, quite the same way you all did it. But we're coming with a process, and we study what you all done, and we're trying to build something we call the State of Black Atlanta as an incubator for our people's assembly process here in Atlanta.
To some of AK's previous points, the chapters were modeled so that we could reproduce the programs. They have had a consistent and very thriving scout program, and so have we here in Jackson during periods when a period of now of rebuilding. What I mean by rebuilding is actually securing a place to work out of. And of course the Lumumba Center serves that in some capacity, but we're looking to as part of the organizational mandate of having what we call Malcolm X Centers for Self-Determination. And those are, that's the heart of how we organize and run the programs that we need to run in order for us to be effective in the community. And you know, it's as I said, we've been around upwards of 26, 27 years, not only here but across the country. And to AK's point, it is extremely moving to see young people who we remember at such a young age now are moving into positions to take us forward into the 21st century and beyond with new ideas and new innovative thinking, but still based on the principles that they've come out of with through the Scout program and through the principles of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement.
I see so much of, I mean, from my observation of MXGM spaces and all, you know, there is this understanding of equity and equality across gender lines. So I see celebration of women and the role that women play in the organization's leadership. And between the both of you, you have mentioned, you, Akhil, particularly said Safiya was the one who really inspired you to join MXGM, right? Yeah. And I see the dynamic role that Safiya has played across the years and how she pulls people in, and such an inspiring speaker, a mentor, and a nurturer. And I didn't have the pleasure of meeting Nubia, but I know the work that your wife does in the community, and also AK's wife in particular, and the work that she is spearheading in
Colombo.
Colombo School, and also knowing Rukia's work personally and Ebony Lumumba's work, right? And then working with other MXGM women leaders. Can you both throw light on the work that women have been doing through MXGM and the kind of leadership that women are supported by all of you? Like Taliba, of course, I know Taliba and the great work she's doing in Atlanta and everywhere else.
I just finished speaking, so I'll let AK go first.
Well, I think I was just thinking about this earlier today. It's interesting you bring this point up. I think that there was space for our sisters to push and actually help all of us grow in terms of how we saw gender. First, the space was there, but I think we went from one place to another, you know, because you know that a principle of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement is to combat sexism, particularly sexism against women of African descent, right? And so that wasn't a principle at the beginning of our organization. You know, it was something that really through study and really through actual experiences, and I will say it wasn't that the brothers came up with it, it was the sisters who took that up and struggled for it. And so we had strong women in the group, but I think it's to me, and I tell my students this, it's the difference between having a strong woman and then having an organization where we're committed to destroy
in the combat patriarchy.
Right.
You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I think we went from having some strong female leaders like a sister like Safiya Omar.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it took some political education, some political struggle. And I think I don't want to, as a brother, take credit for it. You know what I mean? The women really pushed us.
Mm-hmm.
The women were really vocal, and the women really, and then we all engaged in political political education and political struggle, and that's why we have it as a principle of our organization. It's kind of carried on, and we're still growing. You know, it's not a liberation. I think there's one thing about it's not just the liberation of our oppressors, but it's also we have to liberate ourselves in terms of the type of relationships we have with each other.
That's right.
And so I think when you see these strong sisters and these vocal female leaders within our organization, mm-hmm. or if you see us taking stands in opposition to patriarchy, mm-hmm. I think it kind of comes from this struggle, this and our attempt to. I know Chokwe used to always talk about that we need a cultural revolution. Mm-hmm. And it has to happen right now.
Mm.
So how we relate to each other, it doesn't wait till we get independence or even wait till we have a mayor. You know,
okay. Yeah.
It happens right now. We have to begin to treat each other in different ways, and we have to in some small way reflect the society we're talking about building. And we want our children to see that too. So again, we know we're not perfect people. You know, mm-hmm. we're struggling, all of us, every day, but we hope we're growing, that we're moving in the right direction. So, and we're trying to transform ourselves and be examples that our community can transform themselves into also. So I think that's part of when I think about the sisters in our organization. Mm-hmm. And again, it started with them. You know, we've never been an organization, and we don't come from a type of tradition. We come from a tradition in our community where we recognize there are strong women and strong men in our movement.
Mm.
You know, it's never been the sisters have to stand behind us or by, you know, when we talk about even the Republic of New Africa,
mm-hmm.
There were always women in that organization who led. You know, like I said, when they founded, it was like Queen Mother Moore and Betty Shabazz was there. Mm-hmm. And when you even looked at them in terms of their military, people like our recent ancestor, Fulani Sunni Ali, if you look at the pictures from Land Celebration Day, you saw women out there with guns. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There was women, female freedom fighters, who were always a part of this movement. And so, we stand on the shoulders of others, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Fannie Lou Hamer. Right. She wasn't a person who's going to be quiet to anybody, right?
That's true.
And so, we build on that, and we learn what we and then through studying some of the people today, I remember there was a time when the sisters insisted that we all study a book by Pearl Klee.
And Bell Hooks.
Huh?
And Bell Hooks.
And Bell Hooks. We all had to read them. And we were required to read them. And I remember the Pearl Klee book, Mad at Miles. It was a short book that spoke straight to everybody's heart, and she talked about how many women were in hospitals from domestic violence.
Mm.
And so, you know, so it let us know that this was a serious situation in our communities that we had to be opposed to. As a organization, it wasn't just a women's issue, it was an issue of our people.
Right. Thank you both for sharing that.
Kaliba is listening in right now.
Did she make it?
Kaliba, are you on there?
Is you on to participate?
Jamal is on here.
Oh, hey, Jamal.
All right. Yeah.
What's up, everybody?
I want Kaliba to speak about the national program of MSGM.
Hopefully she'll get in. We got time.
Yeah. I don't hear her yet, but I guess we can go with Jamal until Kaliba makes it. Jamal, you said you had a question, right? Or do you want to kind of sort of introduce yourself and the work you do and then ask your question, please?
He could ask a question along, not in his dissertation. Just joking.
Yeah, so, yeah, my name is Willie Jamal, right? I'm doing this PhD in geography at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And so my work is looking at the legacy of the provisional government, the Republic of New Africa, both in Detroit, where it formed, and in Jackson, Mississippi, where New African citizens relocated to. So in the process of that work, I lived in Detroit for 6 months, and I lived in Jackson for 6 months as well. But I want to hold that question. There were some things, if I could step back, when Baba AK was speaking about the history of the RNA and brothers and sisters, you know, basically, right, picking up roots and moving down to Jackson, moving to Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
A really key part of that, right, of that visioning, right? I think, we when we talk about that history, we have to think about the fact that these were visionaries. Like, they were, you know, envisioning something that they would not necessarily themselves see come to fruition. But in a lot of Dr. Imari Obadeli's writings, right, he was speaking about the need to create what he was calling, what New Africans were referring to as new communities.
Mm-hmm.
So when New African citizens were migrating down to Bolton, Mississippi, initially, right, to purchase this rural land from a black farmer, it was their intent to establish, right, those new communities, which would include housing and schools, right, and healthcare facilities out in rural Hinds County. So they were thinking of a whole new society and building that society themselves, right?
Right.
And much of this literature, when you look through it, Dr. Obadeli was saying, we need everybody. We don't just need the professors or the lawyers or the doctors. We need the carpenters, right? We need the nurses, right? We need the farmers, like whatever. Everyone was welcome. Everyone had a skill that could contribute, right, to this, right, to the freedom of black folk.
Mm.
And it was significant that they saw that happening in the South, right? And they saw it happening on liberated territory in the South. And I say it's significant because I think we see manifestation, we're seeing manifestation of that today in Jackson, right, with Cooperation Jackson and MXG and work that they've been doing there over decades, right? Not only like getting land and creating these community land trusts, but thinking about a way in which, what will a new community look like today, right? Considering we have all this technology, be it via the internet and whatnot, what will a new community look like today in a way in which, say, Obadeli and others couldn't envision because that technology didn't exist then.
Mm.
Gotcha.
What was that, Baba?
I think in some way, and not ruling out the possibility of organizing new communities, but one of the things we wanted to do, because the vision, as you stated, of new communities at that time would be to set it up on what Bobby Murray called virgin land, right?
Mm.
This would be land that wasn't necessarily settled by other people. And plus, I think he was looking at maybe moving people, particularly from the north to the south.
Right.
But our vision, and when I say our, I'm talking about the New African People's Organization, which we haven't talked much about, mm-hmm. was founded in 1984, May 19th. And our thing was looking at what happened to RNA is how can we be more a part of communities that were already in, you know, Jackson, already in Atlanta, already in New Orleans and other places. How can we organize with people who already live there
and build strong communities where people are already at in concert with them. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the concept of a people's assembly, it wasn't like we were asking people, we were coming with another program and saying, look, you got to support our leadership here. No, we're working with people in that community, and together with people in that community, we are organizing what we need. So if you think about it, the slogan for Shokwe's campaign for mayor was what? The people shall decide, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily, the slogan wasn't free to land. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It was the people in this community, we got to come together and we got to make decisions ourselves. And so this was the people's program. You know how, what was the platform called? The people's platform, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was the people's platform. So we didn't want people to see us as just a foreign group who moved into Mississippi or moved into Georgia. We want the people to be very much attached to this program that we've created together with people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the difference, and that's why, you know, the new community is going to have to be built, say, like in communities that are already there with people there. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so that, and again, that's more the vision of MXGM or Cooperation Jackson in terms of building cooperatives right there with people who are in those communities and building neighborhood and people's power in neighborhoods that are right there. So it's a kind of a different strategy. And I'm not saying we don't need new communities, but the vision we have of it today is different from what Imari and them laid out in 1971 and 1970.
Most definitely. And I feel like it should be different, right? We're in a different political context, right? Political thought is supposed to mature and change over time, right? As your opposition changes their tactics as well, you know?
Right.
And right, so there's been, like you were saying, Dr. Moses, that there have been generations of folk living in Jackson and Atlanta, right? And becoming a part of these communities, right? Like, Baba Lumumba was considered a Jacksonian.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, though he was a, you know, native son of Detroit, you know, moving his family and his profession and everything to Jackson, Mississippi, and dedicating himself, right, to the community and the people in Jackson. So I agree with you, right? So the way in which, you know, we say sustainable communities and Black communities in, say, Jackson and Atlanta will be manifested differently, and I feel like they should be.
Mm-hmm. Everybody, Taliba joined the call, so AK, do you want to pose the question to Taliba?
Well, I was saying Taliba's, for those you don't know, Taliba Abuya is like one of the national leaders of MXGM. So I wanted her to speak to like the national program. We talked about what people are doing, what we do in Jackson and in Atlanta in different chapters, but there's a national program at MXGM, right, Taliba? So can you tell us something?
Freelance, Taliba.
Yes, so our national focus of Malcolm X's movement, we have five areas that we're focusing on, that to build out self-determination at local levels to build a national movement. And our first one is looking at young people and doing youth organizing. As an organization, we invest with young people starting at the age of 6. It's with our New African Scouts organization. This is one of the organizations under the New African People's Organization. And essentially, we are doing survival, urban survival skills, nature survival skills. It's grounded in New African culture. And the young people get together, do activities, learn our history, learn cultural things. And in our different chapters, we meet according to, like, those community needs. And then in the summer, we get together and we have a camp, Camp Lucico, which is overnight, and the babies are like out in the woods. They're learning to canoe, they're learning to cook, they're learning different skill sets, and they're also getting different badges. And with this investment, we know that if we invest in our young people, we invest in our babies. Even as I said, we start at 6. From 6 to 13, we have cubs, and then at 13 to 17, we have panthers. We prepare them to ground themselves in liberation work and in self-determination work. And then we're looking at land and building an institution. This is whether it's acquiring land, as we just did. We greet each other with Freedom Land. We know self-determination, again, revolution is about land having place. And so we're looking at how do we liberate ourselves, whether that's through our actual land building, having our own right places that we can go, that we can offer as a resource to our people, building out institutions, and with that lens to the youth and things of, and thoughts of cooperatives. And I know you all in Jackson, we have Cooperation Jackson, and it's really just offering a different alternative to economic systems, seeing and honoring that we do have what we need. And so there's a few different cooperatives, and I definitely like the listeners that's talking here. Definitely look into Cooperation Jackson as an alternative to capitalism. And also just thinking about that survival as well. Like, how are we using what we have to build what we need? And as Baba mentioned before, and it's been a part of the conversation tonight, we are looking at people's assemblies. And so how we use that process in Jackson, a participatory democracy process, one person, one vote, essentially, again, with self-determination, we can get what we need, or we know what we want, and we must decide at the end of the day, which I think is just so genuine about Malcolm X grassroots movement, about, like, the New African Independence Movement and the demand for self-determination, is that the Black nation, Black people, free from enslavement, the saving of our ancestors, but in this country now, we still should have the right to decide what we want. We believe in that as a human right, self-determination. And above, to connect with all of this and to actualize this, we are also focusing in on self-defense. And I just think that's very practical. We look and view self-defense as a human right. But even currently, what we're seeing under new administration, what I'm pretty sure folks are seeing in their local municipalities, at state levels, at federal levels, there's been, again, this time where we're seeing when people responded to a young Black male murdered and then laid in the street and not even a care or respect for his body. And young people of Ferguson had their uprising, and the nation sparked off, and we continued to build and question police brutality. And young people took to the streets. Young people started new organizations. Young people resisted. Young people said no, Black Lives Matter, and that showed up in different ways. What we're seeing now, again, that there's a repression that is coming to that, whether that's legally, whether that's through white militias forming, whether we're just having these different incidents of violence, threat of violence. We're definitely seeing and noticing that we have to be, we have to have self-defense. And that's both, again, physically, we have to defend ourselves off of political repression. Definitely the history of Black Power Movement, the Black Independence Movement, we see what the fight for self-determination and what responses can come from that. And so we're investing in looking at self-defense and just reassembling that. And through these five areas, always creating tools and ways to, like, even apply this and make this accessible to the people. So thinking about self-defense in 2012, the Malcolm X grassroots movement did every 28 hours. And that report really shone light on police brutality in this country. And we followed that up and concluded out 2012 with a book called Operation Ghetto Storm. And these things are available on our website. But most importantly, a piece that came out of that is the organizing handbook called Let Your Model Be Resistance. And it really talks about, like, community organizing, centering self-defense, and protecting yourself in our communities. And so, like, that's just a piece with that around self-defense, people's assemblies. We have write-ups on the Jackson Kush plan. After out in Oakland with other organizations, are moving a process called State of Black Oakland to handle some local things there. State of Black Atlanta is kicking off in Atlanta to say, like, what is the State of Black Atlanta? What do we want to do so we can create that agenda for Black Atlanta? And so, again, Cooperation Jackson, as I stated, like, many resources there. And so while we're focusing on these particular five areas, and what I like what Baba AK was highlighting earlier, we're not per se prescribing to people, but from our lane, from our perspective, demanding self-determination, extending and continuing the new African independence movement that came after the Black Power movement, we are providing these tools and making them accessible. So yeah, I'll stop there for questions, but that's just how, or more common in conversation. But those are the areas that we're looking at, and we're building that up at different, in different ways in different cities.
Thank you so much, Taliba. So Mikaya is here right now, and Mikaya, do you want to say something?
Free the land, folks.
All right.
Free the land.
Do you want to... Oh, Mikaya is actually not too well. He's got a cold, so he's not going to be participating in the conversation today, but he's not going to be off the hook next week. We're going to try and bring Hondo also to the conversation so that they can share the founding stories of... the history of MXGM in Jackson particularly, and then we can move on into what's happening right now. At this time, I would like to ask any of you to talk about the role of MXGM in electoral politics. Talk about the work that MXGM has done during Katrina.
Okay, I'll start, and then AK and Taliba can add as we move along. I know here in Jackson, after Katrina, the storm hit, and it not only hit Louisiana, but it devastated parts of the southern coast of Mississippi. We formed a coalition here in Mississippi, the Mississippi Disaster Relief Coalition, along with some other groups, the Nation of Islam, the NAACP, Republic of New Africa, and several other groups and church groups here. And our mission was to go and go into New Orleans, the first part of that. Go into New Orleans and to do an assessment of how we could best serve our people who had been so devastated. And so we were able to tap into our chapters across the country and other groups and individuals, and provide tremendous amounts of supplies that we were able to truck into New Orleans. As part of that work, we also organized survivors' councils. As a matter of fact, we had a large gathering here in Jackson, a survivors' council, where people who had been displaced out of New Orleans were able to come and participate and help spearhead how they viewed what needed to be done in order for them to have the right to return and to have their rights respected in New Orleans. Out of that work came a huge return rally in March where over 5,000 people participated in New Orleans. And from that work, the Hurricane Disaster Relief Fund was put in motion, whereby the late Chokwe Lumumba was part of the organizing board of that group, and many of our MXG people participated. Kali Akuno actually headed the office that was in New Orleans. And other chapters of MXG worked to have students and young people come down during the summer to do actually do work. And I think, Saliba, did you participate in that?
I did, yes, Katrina on the ground.
Yes, I went.
That was actually during spring break.
Spring break, yeah. 4 weeks of spring break.
So could you elaborate on some of that work?
Yes, sure. We I remember meeting as students wanted to organize it or introduce it as a spring break alternative. And so there were just different regional invites in different schools depending on their spring break coordinated folks coming down. And we did go, and it was really powerful too, I can say, as a younger organizer, being that that was almost 12 years ago. We met in Alabama, and that's already a legacy and a history of our people in this country. Baba, were we in Selma?
We were in Selma, Alabama.
We were in Selma, Alabama, and we pulled up. It's dark. It's late. We drove in from Georgia to Alabama, and I think originally where we were going to go was overbooked, and, you know, there's, like, lights, and you could see it, and it was, like, off of a main city, and then it was, like, this closed-down public elementary school that, I guess, overflow had came, and you could see just, like, people who looked like aunties and uncles to me, and I think they were just trying to accommodate us and find a space, and but there was no running water in our location. So they was like, oh, we can get gallons, but we can get gallon jugs, and they felt bad, you know, just that good old Southern house, like, black hospitality. I mean, we thought, like, what do we do about this? Because then at the same time, my uncles, mind you, I'm still like a college student, and my 20-something and uncles, 50, 60, like, we'll stay up. We're going to be, like, protecting y'all while y'all sleep, because you just didn't know what might have happened. And I still remember, I writing poetry of, like, the big trees and, like, the moss that was hanging. And I was like, we'll be okay for a night. And I think we grounded ourselves that, Kim, because, you know, that kind of startled people. We don't have water. What are we going to do? How does this work? How does this happen? And we were like, our people sat in the Superdome for 5 days with no water. Can we not do a night if we know what we're coming for? And it just grounded us. And so the next day we woke up and we hit the Gulf. And ironically enough, my group from Georgia State, shout out Panthers, but we, because a lot of people did still want us to go into New Orleans, we end up, we went to a small city in, we went to Slidell, Louisiana. And we were doing work there, and it basically was like just four areas. And basically, like, we needed to show up for our people, because yes, it wasn't like it was a good mission, like, oh, look what I did, some recovery. It was the fact that, like, our people, it was like a political, like, fault as well, because then we saw that people were, like, losing their homes if they weren't removing the trash or removing, like, the debris from the flood that happened. Mind you, this happened, like, what, 5 months ago, 6 months out from the hurricane storm that that the country said that they couldn't respond to. They were expecting people to have their properties cleaned up to show ownership of their property. So we were basically just split into four working areas, like finding people who have been dispersed and displaced throughout the U.S. Empire. We were helping with cleanup so people can hold on to their lands and couldn't be taken from them because they said that they were abandoned. We were helping folks process through FEMA because, again, you know, racism was showing up in that way. And then, most importantly, we were censoring and having folks be able to return home. And it began a kind of a project of the right to return, because also some of the political pieces, like, oh, these were refugees, referring to black people, referring to born people in this land. And then that question of our citizenship once again came up. And even as a refugee, quote unquote, then there were certain responsibilities that were supposed to happen. But what we ultimately saw, that it was this place just to push out our people to these random places And, you know, there was a thing about internal displacement. So I'll pause there, but that was just some of our work. Like, not only just, like, cleaning up and doing things, but also helping our people return home.
Mm-hmm. Can I add something?
Sure, sure, though.
Yeah. Because Talib was telling it from the perspective of a young person who went down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the elders, right?
Mm-hmm.
Helping to put it together. Mm-hmm. I wasn't leading it. Let me start by saying that this whole effort, at least in terms of getting the students down there, two people led it. Kevin Powell, the writer, and Rukia Lumumba.
Okay. That's true.
They were the people who initiated it and put the call out. And so I'm a professor at Georgia State. And so I think I put out the announcement and 39 students from Georgia State responded. But every weekend during the month, I think, of March that year, there were at least 200 to 300 students from all across, maybe even more than that, from all across the United States. Because I helped transport other students there during the other week who were flying to Atlanta, and I would take them to Selma where they would be oriented, as Talibah mentioned. But this is the part of the story I want to tell. I get to Selma at the high school she's talking about. Actually, it's a place called 21st Century. And I find out when we get there, it's not going to be any water. So I'm thinking, man, I got all these young people with me, and they're going to be whining. They're going to be crying about ain't no water. And then I was so proud because when we met about it, and Talibah and the other young people weren't even in the meeting. They were just sitting around the meeting. And when they heard the problem of the water, they said, look, we're not here on vacation. We came here to work. And they said, they're the ones that came up with the idea. Just go get some bottled water and bring it here to this facility. And we will do what's necessary. We know how to deal. And, you know, to me, it really, I learned a lot because, you know, as an elder, a lot of times we put down younger generations and say, you know, they ain't ready or they spoiled or whatever. But they showed that they were soldiers, you know, and I was so proud. And I will say that's another piece I think one of the things I'm proud of our organization about is we're very intergenerational. You know, it's not just old folks running it, or it's not just youth. But because we know that one of the major things in our struggle is we got to go from one generation to the next.
Right.
So I think that work around Katrina, I'm so glad you asked about it. Another piece and was that Shokwe, Kwame Kalamara, and other people led this whole effort around the tribunal, which we had in New Orleans. Where it was the international tribunal where we had representatives from South Africa, from Venezuela, from Brazil, from Palestine, from Algeria, and they Haiti, and they sat on a tribunal that heard what happened in Katrina and what was the responsibility of the federal government, what were the things that happened in state government and local government, like some of the things that were exposed later about how police actually murdered people, people who were trying to survive in Mississippi and just being outright killed by New Orleans police. It was first released at this tribunal.
Yes.
Later on, people would be charged by the Justice Department, but it was first coming to people's attention and people got a chance for the first time to speak about these things at this tribunal. What year was that held, Akil? Was it in 2011?
I think it was. Let me see, Katrina was 05.
05, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was.
Oh, so it would have been the following year, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. We haven't done a good job of documenting. I guess that's why it's good Jamal's on this call.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it was.
Just in talking about it, I'm thinking about there's so many parts to to what people have done over the years. And, you know, everybody who's on this call has contributed in some way to this work that's been done. And we got to do it from different perspectives, because, like, I see it from one perspective, but what Talibah said was important.
Mm-hmm.
So we got the elder and the young person who's there, our different vantage points. Because I don't think she ever heard me say how I was feeling at that moment. And how proud I was of the fact that they soldiered up.
Yeah. It spoke to coming out of the experience, and as I said, that was another that tribunal in New Orleans that was held, but also the survivors tribunal that preceded that in 05 were different iterations of the concepts of the People's Assembly.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit more, about the survivors tribunals?
Yeah. There was obviously, you know, people evacuated out of New Orleans, and a lot of people settled here in Jackson, as well as places in between here and New Orleans. And again, part of our work, as Talibah mentioned, moved not only from help and assistance, but also to the political aspect. And we talked to a lot of displaced New Orleanians
mm-hmm.
here about what would they feel we needed to do and how we needed to move.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the people that were directly affected participated in the decision making process of putting these things on, which is extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
That the way our organization is structured, our philosophy is that we have to involve the people in their participation in our own liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an example of that, as we did that, the Survivors Council here, and over 1,000 people attended here at one of the local churches, Anderson United Methodist Church. And as I said, out of that came the political framework of what later turned out to be the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, and the work that came through Katrina on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the struggles around the political obstacles that we were attempting to overcome around housing, and obviously public housing.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, there were two perfectly stable housing units there that was roughly about 12,000 to 13,000 units that disaster capitalism tore down in order to gentrify the area.
Mm-hmm.
And to make sure not only that Black people had been dispersed and displaced all across the U.S. empire, but those that were there would not live in a certain area close to downtown.
Wow. So in my conversations with you, Akhil, you have mentioned the youth work that the Jackson chapter has done through the Malcolm X Center.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Would you want to talk about that, to give context to the intergenerational engagement that happened in Mississippi, or particularly Jackson?
Yeah, as AK and Talibah mentioned, the youth initiative that comes out of the North African People's Organization, the New African Panthers and Scouts. Well, again, young people here in Jackson have went through that program. My children went through that program, as well as Chokwe Antar, Rukia, and others have gone through that program, and current children
mm-hmm.
are going through that program. And so part of that work centered around youth. We've spearheaded by the late Mayor Chokwe Lumumba and myself at varying points in time, we had athletic programs that had to do around basketball.
Right.
And I mean, literally hundreds of young people had come through that program, and it not only allowed them the opportunity to expand their purview and to travel and immerse in the culture of basketball, but we also taught the culture of who we are and the work, and it also afforded literally hundreds of young people in order to the ability to go to college.
Mm.
And so that helped, again, solidify and root ourselves in the community,
mm.
in the practical aspect of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so we still do that kind of work. We've worked in the communities with in various degrees where we had young people who were been part of local street organizations,
mm-hmm.
and we've worked with them over the years, and we've had several that have come through. There's a young man that he's a teacher now, and he wrote a book. As a matter of fact, he dedicated a lot of that book to MXG and Shokwe because he came through our AAU basketball program,
mm-hmm.
and he talks about the struggles he had as a young person. And if not for coming through our program, our basketball program, then he really wouldn't know where his life would have taken him.
Mm.
So that's the kind of work that we've done, not only here in Jackson, but in Atlanta, or in New York, or in Alabama, or in California. That's how our organization is structured, and that's the kind of work that we do.
Mm. Thank you so much. We are at 10 minutes before closing the show today, so I would love for each of you, Taliba, AK, and Akhil, and if possible, Willie, Jamal, to kind of sort of make parting comments, 2-3 minutes each of parting comments about MXGM, RNA, New African People's Organization, or what is happening right now to what has happened before. Anything you want to talk about to kind of close out today's session, knowing that we will pick up the conversation and we will continue the conversation next week, same time, for another 2 hours.
Well, I would like to say that encourage everybody who's listening. One of the most important initiatives that all of us are engaged in is to support this election, and it's going to happen on May 2nd. You know, why would I like to say that? Because when Shokwe Lumumba became mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, it was important for Jackson, but people all around the country, even some places outside of the United States of America, like in Haiti, saw that as a victory.
That's right.
And so I think, you know, I saw the slogan of restoring the vision.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. I think that vision and what it means to a lot of us with a victory for Shokwe Antar Lumumba would be a victory for many of us, and it would be an example for other places. And so we ask everybody listening, what's the website for the campaign?
www.lumumbaformayor.com. Lumumba, FOR4Mayor.com.
So, if, you know, anything we said tonight, if it resonated with you and you support that work, contribute to the campaign, or if you got some time, you know, during the before the election, come down there and contribute your time. That's very important. And so, and I also would like to say, I would like to thank you all for inviting me to participate in this conversation. I put the phone on mute a few minutes ago, and I was talking to my wife, Amanat, and I said, man, I hope we record this thing, because there's been so much history talked about tonight.
It's recorded, Rock. It'll be available in curated form on this website.
Very good. Very good. I'm going to use it myself to help me in some things. <to write. laughs> So that's all I have to say. Free the land.
Free the land.
Okay. Again, I'd first like to thank Noel and the producers of this podcast. I really appreciate them reaching out and allowing us to share our story. I'd also like to thank my brothers and sisters in struggle, Willie Jamal, a.k.a. Saliba, for joining us and helping tell this part of the story. What I'd like to part with to the listening audience is that we feel that we're doing some very special work here in Jackson, Mississippi. We're doing it all over the U.S. Empire, but particularly here in Jackson. If we can create a model of resistance and self-determination here using whatever strategy and tactics that we deem and the people deem necessary, that it will help galvanize our people in struggling against the repression and the backwardsness of the U.S. Empire. So I would encourage people to come down, call us, move down. There's Mississippi is a beautiful place with a tremendous amount of land and a tremendous amount of cheap land. So come on down. Oh, one other thing, too, before I go, I'd make sure that please listen to Voices from the Grassroots every Thursday night at 7 p.m. That's the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement's local radio program. We stream live over the internet at coalitionjustice.net, as well as audio at WMPR901.com. And we also stream live over Facebook at JXN Coalition for Economic Justice. So you can always tune in, call in. And those programs are archived as well. So if you can't get us at 7 o'clock, you can always go to coalitionjustice.net and view that the current show and previous shows.
Taliba.
Yes, Frieda Lynn. Most definitely, thank you very much for having this space and creating this space. I'm so honored to be a part of this family and then to be in struggle and for liberation with all. I definitely co-sign all things that were said previously. And I do want to just leave the listeners, folks who might listen to this down the road, the history that was shared, thinking about the new African independence movement. Sometimes as folks are moving towards freedom, we've developed language and words that are grounded in, like, in true and real meaning. So things like free to land is necessary. When we say reparations, that's tied to something. And what I would just invite people to know, even as it's being 2017, and next year it'll be 2018, 50 years after the assassination of Martin Luther King, that our fight did not start with the civil rights movement, which many of them would say was a human rights movement. Mm-hmm. It continued on to the Black Power movement, and we say groups like SNCC or CORE, the Black Panther Party, and we may not know that other organizations was around, like RAM and House of Emoja, but then that movement also continued into the New African Independence Movement. And so to be a part of an organization that stands on those very shoulders, that continue to be present while we're in the 21st century still demanding liberation and self-determination, I just offer young people that are a big part of our organization to, like, not let our fight for liberation be ahistorical. Know that we have been demanding this. I just came out of an academy this past weekend with the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, and just to think about things that people were speaking on when we think about our political exiles, Mama Sada Shakur, Mama Nahanda Obudun, mm-hmm. Black women, and Black women's leadership is not new to us. Queer women's leadership is not new to us. It begs me to pull up Kwesi Baba Ogun, who was an openly out queer Black man who was the leader of the Black Liberation Army. So maybe some of these narratives, as we continue to fight for Black liberation, may see new or nuances if we start our history on certain lines. But I just invite us to look at this history of fighting for self-determination and understanding that our call has always been a human rights movement. And I'll stop there because I can get excited. But thank you again for inviting me to the
you
call.
You have to stop.
Thank you, Taliba. Jamal.
Yeah, I just wanted to express my gratitude to not everyone, not just everyone on the call, but everybody in Detroit and Jackson that welcomed me into your homes and your family. You know, I'd only been to Jackson once. That was for Jackson Rising. I had never been to Detroit, you know. But people welcomed me and trusted me and sat and broke bread with me. So I'm mad grateful for that. But I also want to echo what Baba AK and Akil were stating in terms of people coming down to Jackson and sharing their time, their skill sets, their expertise to what's being built in Jackson and moving to Jackson, but also looking at where you're at, you know what I'm saying, whatever city you're at, and thinking about a way in which you can, you know, redo or recreate your neighborhoods, right, the areas where you're at, because like Jackson doesn't stand alone, right? It doesn't stand alone within this country, and it doesn't stand alone within the diaspora.
That's right.
And I think, you know, Soko Antar speaks, I've heard him speak on that quite a few times, right, when he's connecting Jackson to other cities, right, when he's talking about that pothole to pothole analogy that he makes, right? He said the way our people live in Jackson are the same way our people are living, you know, whether it's in Chicago or New York, right, or whether it's in somewhere in Brazil. And so I think it's important to not just look to Jackson and hold up Jackson, but also see how a way in which we can learn from Jackson and apply some of those tactics, right? What we're learning from them, where we presently stationed.
That's right.
I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, AK, Akil, Mikaya, Jamal, Taliba. Thank you all so much for taking part in this amazing conversation today. We are going to come back to talk about a lot of history and a lot of radical work that's happening, again, all over the country and the world. We are going to make those global connections and talk about solidarity that's building. So we are done for today. Thank you, everybody, again, and free the land.
Free the land.
We're out. Free the land. By any means necessary.
That's great. Yes, I'm great.